Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. Today, I will discuss that which has been on my mind over the last 2 weeks, I suppose, relating to the aspects of our life that are affected by aging. Now, when we are aging, our bodies change, our situations change, our health and energy levels change. Hello? We have to go through a transformation which significantly impacts us, which significantly transforms the way in which we see ourselves and the world around us. Now, under the usual circumstances, this is considered to be normal, considered to be something that everybody has to deal with, and therefore not generally considered in the way in which one considers it when there's a crisis. When you are younger, or let's say in a good situation with one's vitality, one doesn't consider the process of aging as something to worry about too much. But when one is faced with a situation which forces one to consider aging, it changes the way one views this inevitable transformation or stage of life. My Uncle Ange said something which I probably repeated before, which I found very interesting. He said, "If I knew I was going to live so long, I would have taken better care of myself." In other words, if he was aware of the fact that he would have suffered because of the consequences of his actions when he was young, he would have considered it more important when he was younger to prepare for the later stage. But hindsight is perfect, perfect vision. When you look backwards, you see everything clearly, you see everything perfectly. Unfortunately, we live towards the future, not towards the past. And because of that, we do not deal with the future as perfectly as we presently think we should have dealt with the past. Now, many people in their younger years do everything absolutely perfectly and still die young in an accident or some in a war or in a way which is unexpected. Some people don't pay attention at all to their health, to their diet, to the way they live. They just enjoy life to the fullest, and they live a very healthy and satisfied life. And there are people who live like that and get themselves into terrible health situation. It is very hard to give a specific methodology of life which will be universally successful. So one has to consider that what really counts is to live life with care. Whatever we do, we should be careful how we do it. Here I have a glass I'm holding, and this glass has certain characteristics. It is fragile to certain situations, like being dropped or being cracked against something. It will be destroyed and no longer function as a glass. If I put ice into this glass and freeze it and then pour hot water into it, it will break immediately. Now, if I care about the glass, if I wish to keep it over longer periods of time, I will avoid those situations as best I can, which cause the destruction of the glass. Now, our bodies and our environment around us, the social situations within which we live, are similar there are things which are advantageous for it and things which are disadvantageous. And it is our responsibility to ourselves to carefully chart our way through life, to make things as, shall we say, harmonious as possible, as proper as possible, so that we avoid damaging situations. Because when we have to suffer the consequences of improper actions in our bodies or in our minds or in our relationships, we suffer terribly because of the way we have created a situation. And it is even worse when we blame ourselves for the situation we are in, when we see that we have created our own problem. Now, although we may beat ourselves up about acting improperly and placing ourselves in an improper situation, in many respects, it is not really our fault. Now, this is not an absolute rule, and I'm not going to say something which is to be taken literally in all respects, but I'm going to give a few examples to show how difficult it is to do the right thing, health-wise or emotionally or psychologically. I like to research medical things. I like to stay in touch with the latest trends in the health profession. And over the past 20, 25 years I've been doing this, I've seen some amazing things. I've seen where researchers have said, this is a wonderful thing to do, and then 10, 15, 20 years later, when they do other kinds of tests, they find out this is the very worst thing you could have done. Things that previously were accepted as normal, as healthy, as good for you, later on turn out to be the causes of cancer or hypertension or difficulties in many respects. Previously, we were recommended to take lots of supplements, to supplement our diets, to get greater intake of vitamins or minerals, which would be good for us. Nowadays, those who are more informed say, better to avoid all these supplements and just get everything you need from diet, because these supplements are causing difficulties and troubles to the body. Nowadays, we find people are moving towards very, shall we say, commonsensical understandings of life. And that's a good thing. You'll find that a lot of this comes basically down to moderation, temperance, maintaining a basic level of balance between your needs and your desires. Now, it's very interesting that we have discussed this previously about the situation of desire, what gives us life, what gives us passion in life, what gives us this reason for our existence. And then at the same time, we have to be temperate, we have to be moderate, because if we overdo any particular aspect, we suffer the consequences of deterioration or breakdown in our health or in our situation or in our emotional or psychological balance. After all, part of the passion of life is to eat good food. Part of that passion is to do that within an environment, a friendly environment, within a loving environment. But foods which are too fatty, or which are too salty, or which are too spicy, or which are too, shall we say, incompatible with us, we may be allergic or sensitive to them, or they may be overcooked, or they may be rotten, or they may have contamination, these things do not help us. Actually, the recommendations in the Vedic culture are very, very useful for maintaining that balance between passion and temperance. Even in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna recommends not to eat too much or to eat too little. This is a very, very important principle right there. If you don't eat too much, you don't overload your digestive system. When you don't overload your digestive system, it remains healthy, and you will always have an appetite to eat more. When you eat a lot, what happens is your pancreas gets overloaded. It puts out a lot more insulin also, and you start to develop diabetes in your older age when you eat very large meals only a few times a day, because it creates an imbalance in the way in which your body uses sugar. But eating smaller amounts more times of the day balances the body's sugar and also allows the digestion to roar throughout the day. Now, that's especially important when you get older. And don't eat too little. Don't eat the wrong things. Don't eat things which are not giving you enough nutrition, because your body is a machine, a biochemically based physiological organism which requires the proper balance of minerals, vitamins, energies, and so on to maintain itself, unless you follow Jasmine and you don't eat at all. Now, it makes perfect sense, naturally, that anyone who has a physical body should very carefully maintain the balance of the body. But there needs to be a lot of common sense, too. Most of us don't have that common sense when it comes to eating. But in the Vedic literature, we also find foods in the mode of goodness, passion, and ignorance. This is kind of an interesting list. Of course, that's a very simplistic version of it, because in Ayurveda, it gives foods according to our constitution. But the idea being that some things are good for us, some things are not, it's an important point. If you live according to your constitution, if you live compatibly with your constitution, you will be in much better shape throughout your life than if you disregard it and work against it. So we still have this major problem, balancing the passion for life and the temperance, which allows us to live life in a compatible and harmonious way. What is your nature to find passion in life? What is it within your life that gives you that feeling that you are making a significant contribution into this world and giving yourself that excitement and enthusiasm you need to can go on in life? And then how to accomplish that within the context of doing things according to your constitutional nature as a living entity within this world we live in. This is the basic task that we have to deal with. It doesn't matter whether you are a person interested in spiritual evolution or not. Everybody is faced with this task. Don't deal with the passion of life, that which gives you a reason to exist, and you become lifeless. Don't deal with the way in which that can be integrated into your physiological existence, and you'll become sick and diseased and regret it. If you are a spiritualist and you neglect to find some passion in life, your endeavors to expand your spirituality, to develop yourself, will, without a doubt, be hindered. You will become weakened in your enthusiasm for life itself, which will weaken your enthusiasm to advance. But even if you have that passion, yet you neglect to integrate that in a very holistic and harmonious manner in your practical life, your body and so on, it will become weakened to such an extent that you will not be able to fulfill the passion of your life. Everyone in this world has to deal with these two things. The problem is that most don't even recognize they have to deal with these two things until they get a lot older. When you're younger, you go out with the passion of life and you don't really care too much about the support of it, because the body's young, it can deal with a lot of things. But when you get older, the effects of that lack of concern hit you very strongly and diminish your quality of life. But you don't become aware of that until you're older, because one cannot see the consequences of what one is doing. When one is doing it, it requires a kind of a mystic capacity. So what does one do? I mean, even if you were to follow basic trends in health, later on it may turn out that these trends are harming you. Now, I am not, by philosophical inclination, a person who is mainly concerned with... I'm not a person who's concerned at all with maintaining some kind of cultural connection to any historical people, ancient culture, or foreign cultures that are not part of my life today. You know that already. Yet I have enormous respect, enormous appreciation for example, very properly implemented Ayurvedic understandings of diet or body constitution, or the Tibetan or Chinese forms of understanding meridians and the way in which energy flows in the body, or the way in which our physiologies can be so seriously affected by things which have nothing to do with chemical intake, for example, in supplements or whatever, or medicines. For example, I'm a pitta person, and when I take things, pitta means very fiery person internally. So if I take things, foods which increase fire, it'll just make me sick. I need foods which can cool me down, or at least foods which balance that fire with the other elements, or which keep things under control. To take something which will increase an already hot situation would be disadvantageous. So I've seen, amazingly so, that most of the medicines from the allopathic tradition increase the pitta within my body. They increase the heat within my body, even though they may very nicely deal with a temporary physical situation. Now, one may wonder where I'm going with this discussion, and I'd like to tell you, just to relieve the anxiety of doubt. Now, obviously, there are many ways in which one could live. Obviously, there are many paths one could take. Obviously, there are many situations one has to be aware of. But one could spend one's whole life trying to perfect all of these little details of how to live. This could become a very big project. But let's consider one point. Why are doctors so rarely sick? Now, even those in the hospital, they're connected with all kinds of diseases right there in the hospital. Hospitals themselves are filled with infections that have developed over time, which are impervious to antibiotics. They are in situations which normally anyone would get sick in, but they don't get sick. Sometimes I go to doctor's offices, very rarely, and just by walking in that place or taking a test in that place, I get sick from all of the sickness which comes into that place. Now, I'm not saying doctors never get sick, but considering they very rarely get sick, considering the circumstances they are in. Now, why is that? Is that because they live better? Because they know more? I don't think so, because many doctors still smoke, and that's insane if you think about it. Do they necessarily eat better? I doubt it. A lot of them eat junk food because they're so in a hurry and so busy all the time, they have hardly any time to eat properly. Now, I haven't made, obviously, a research survey on doctors, their habits, how often they get sick, or so on. But it's generally understood that doctors are an amazingly healthy bunch considering who they deal with every day. You've seen in ancient cultures, in India, in China, in the Philippines, or wherever, you've got these, or in the Amazonian jungles, really old people continue to assist others as physicians. They are really old and still in good shape. Why? That's the question one should ask. Well, why is this? The answer will give us a key to how to deal with our lives, especially as we grow older, and especially as we have no control over what we did in the past, to put us in the situation we are in today. Doctors, nurses, health professionals of various kinds are spending the day working to cure others, to help others, to assist others, to relieve others. Their whole outlook is towards others, reaching out to be of service to others. Let's put aside the money they make for a second. The basic theme is to help others. There are, of course, doctors who are total exploiters of people who are just simply after money and couldn't really care less about patients. There are those who make drugs, pharmaceutical companies, which are the same. I don't consider them in this conversation. But for those who have that basic underlying idealism to be of service in the health field, they are a very healthy and interesting bunch. That energy of giving, that energy of being of service, that energy of trying to help others places them in a kind of mystical bubble which takes care of themselves even when they don't. So that energy of being of service, that energy of wanting to assist others in this way, protects them. Even those who work as healers have seen that when they put their healing energy into others, when it flows through them, it assists them in a very meaningful way too. Now, let's expand that very interesting observation into other aspects of our lives and see if we can come up with some kind of a principle which will help us deal with life. Now, there are people who really need love, really need appreciation, really need acknowledgement, or even really need prosperity. I might even be so bold as to presume, that nowadays almost all of us are in that situation. We all feel overworked, underpaid, underappreciated, unloved in many respects. Now, just examine that. If you bring together a group of 20 people and they were to be incredibly honest, which is very rare, if not impossible, but if they were to be incredibly honest, you might see the following situation. You might see that they all feel underappreciated. They all feel the same way, yet at the same time, they don't go out of their way to relieve that in others. Now, remember the situation of the doctor and remember the situation of giving that service of healing protects one. Just consider that in terms of love, in terms of appreciation, in terms of acknowledgement or respect. Those who give love, who are always there in love for others and wishing to be of service to others, are always living within that love and therefore never feel lack of love. Those who always acknowledge others, appreciate others, by giving that acknowledgement and appreciation, find that they are acknowledged and appreciated simply because of that act. Think of God, think of the divine. The divine loves unconditionally, acknowledges every being, appreciates every being. Therefore, we in return always feel that acknowledgement and appreciation and love for God in some way or another. What we give is what we get. And I don't mean in the business sense, I give you two apples, you give me one back. I mean, the fact of our giving is the act of our receiving. To acknowledge others, to appreciate others is a great service. To just listen to others, to hear how they feel, to appreciate it, to understand it without judging them or condemning them or thinking badly about them in any way, but to simply deeply understand them is an incredibly powerful service. Those who are engaged in that way do not worry that much about their own situations. Of course, yes, they have the feeling they wish to be acknowledged, they wish to be appreciated, they wish to be loved. After all, we're all people. But they are not needy and desperate for it in the same way that those who do not give it to others are. A way to look at selfishness would be to say, when you're only concerned with taking and getting and not giving, there is no problem with getting for oneself. It is not that the world is arranged so that you only give, you never get. Selfishness is not something which is defined simply because you get something. But it's getting and taking to the exclusion of wanting to share or give. When we are concerned with sharing, when sharing becomes a axiomatic fundamental principle in our lives, when we share, we are part of that which is shared. When we share love, that love is with us. When we share acknowledgement, that acknowledgement is with us. When we share appreciation, that appreciation is with us. When we share understanding, that understanding is with us. These forms of sharing are part of the fundamentally, spiritually, essentially important aspects of our existence. And if you go back to that room of that hypothetical room of 20 people sitting around and being dreadfully honest with each other, you will find those who have the greatest problems are those who share the least. Those who share have significantly less problems. You notice I never said no problems. Nobody has no problems. But they have significantly less problems than those who do not feel the need to, do not feel inclined to, do not want to share themselves with others. I don't think the present difficulties that the world is going through today are specifically related to selfishness, because I think there is a much deeper and much broader reason for why nowadays things seem so strange, so tense, and so out of control. It boils down to not having the capacity, or not developing the capacity, because everyone has the capacity, without developing the capacity to share, to be concerned with, to care about others, the whole environment of interaction becomes tense. It becomes difficult. It becomes into a state of conflict, of tension. And to develop an appropriate response to this tension, to relieve the conflicts that are there, we have to go down to the fundamental principles which we all deal with consciously or subconsciously. And those principles are almost always connected with our inability to acknowledge others, appreciate others, respect others, to love others, or to care about them, to understand others, to care even enough to understand without even having to give anything. We don't even feel that we have a need or responsibility to understand others. So what does all this have to do with aging, growing old, maturing? I think that as one accumulates volumes of experience, volumes of data in dealing with others, in dealing with life, in dealing with situations, one starts to build a picture of the world which is extremely different from the picture one had when one was young. The idea of idealism, the concept of idealism, the value of idealism, the ideal to be idealistic is something one has before one enters into family life, and something one regains in a powerful way when family life is no longer a burden or a responsibility for one. For those who are aware, the idealistic values come when one is less concerned about oneself and one's environment and more concerned with the family of mankind. The family of living beings, including the animals, including the nature. When idealism can understand the energy which connects us all, that loving energy, that energy there in that matrix of balance that connects all things and all beings, that idealism comes and manifests as a way to be of service within that unity of living energy. And when one is in that idealism, it's not a fantasy ideal or a theoretical ideal. When one is actually within that ideal, which means the ideal situation, one feels connection like that, and that which one is connected to supports us and is being of service to us. And if Mahashaya could have translated that properly, we should all give him a round of applause, because that's probably one of the most complicated paragraphs I ever said. But anyway, this is what I'm trying to get to the point of, is that there's much more to aging than, for example, the biological age. It's a question of ripening. It's a question of maturing one's understanding, to bring about an understanding of what it really means to take care of oneself, what it really means to be connected with others, what it really means to be in a harmonious situation. For it is this understanding which supports us in all ways in our life, which gives us that acknowledgement, gives us that appreciation, gives us that love, gives us that support in the very basis of our existence. So I suppose I will stop there, because these are just things I've been thinking of in the last week. It's not like it's a very major topic in that sense. I was just sharing with you my realizations as I become more and more aware of aging. And I hope that something within this conversation has helped you to think a little more. I didn't expect to give like formulas and answers. It was really just a sharing of my own feelings, even though I may have spoken it as if it was some kind of like topic, but actually it was just a sharing of experience. You know, it's kind of also hard week after week to come up with something unique to talk about. And I hope that I can continue to be of service in this way. I'd like more feedback from the audience, more indications of what would be good to do, not good to do, and so on. Okay, so we'll stop there. We'll have break until a quarter of the hour. And we'll play music in the meantime. Please send your questions via Messenger. Okay, I have some questions here. The first question I think I'll take is, someone is asking me if one doesn't wish to become sick, or the way to prevent oneself from becoming sick is to heal others. So to answer this question, one has to understand who the person is that we are speaking about. In other words, if somebody is for example, a farmer or a car mechanic or an artist or a musician, these people aren't necessarily aren't going to have the capabilities of being a doctor. So therefore, this is not a general rule. Not everybody can be a doctor. Therefore, to make a general rule that the only way to stay healthy is to heal is not a very intelligent thing to say. I only gave that example as a lead-in to how we can understand that what we share, what we give, what we care about is what we are, how we become, how we manifest our own energy. In other words, the better you manifest your love, the more you live within that love. So, therefore, it is not connected that to be healthy you have to heal. But you can heal others without dealing with their health. You can heal them with love. You can heal them with care. You can heal them with compassion. And therefore, healing may take on different forms depending on how you manifest that healing energy. So I hope that I have addressed that particular concern. Now there's another question here, sometimes I have spoken about indigo children, sometimes people get information about indigo children and they want me to speak about that more, because it's sometimes very hard to understand our children. Well, first of all, I would like to confess that when I speak about indigo children, it is something I understand from having some very short but powerful contacts with such children. It is not something I know a lot about. And I wouldn't even know what particular color, quote unquote, they would be. It's just that I've had experiences of intense psychic contacts or intense contacts as if these were very wise personalities far beyond their age, physical. Therefore, I cannot claim to have any particular knowledge that I would like to share with you because, honestly speaking, I don't think I'm much of an authority on it. All I know is that some of these kids are pretty amazing. And therefore, I don't really speak about it too much and don't feel I would have the qualifications to speak about it too much. So, therefore, I don't. It's not that I don't want to, it's just that I can't. Maybe we can arrange to share some kind of communication with somebody who does have such experience, and we can also do it in a broadcast format if we have such a personality. I would also like to link in some guest broadcasters sometimes in an interactive way where they could share with us their realizations and understandings periodically. That would be very nice. Or we could have an interactive discussion with these personalities. I don't know if that could be arranged maybe through the publishing house in Russia or something like that, or maybe some personalities there in Russia who are quite good at their arts, or anywhere else, as a matter of fact. So I know that wasn't the greatest answer to that question, but that's what I could do. Now I've got a very interesting question. I must admit it's a very challenging question. Does it mean that as much one gives God realization to others, one can be more conscious oneself, even if one is really not so advanced or evolved in the beginning? Well, sure, of course, that's true. However, let's define what it means to give God realization to others. That's a pretty heavy statement. I want to distinguish between simply telling something to somebody that you've heard and giving God realization, which is what was in this question. These are very different statements. And even when you think about it, giving God realization, now, how do you give God realization? I wouldn't even begin to understand how one would give it. Now, I understand that the question was not formulated perfectly in English, but I'm jumping on this because I find it a very interesting point. Now, let's take it from two different points. One who actually has some significant amount of realization, spiritual realization, and someone who does not have a significant amount of realization. Let's take these two cases. Now, someone who has very little spiritual realization will have a very hard time sharing that realization with others. Obviously, you can't share what you don't have. But you can share what you have. So therefore, those who do not have much realization would have, by definition, a hard time sharing that. Now, such people could repeat things they have heard. They could quote things they have heard. They could give materials which are useful to others. They can be of service in that way. Let's take the example of setting up, let's say, a computer program. Let's say somebody needs to set up a computer program and they ask me how to do it. And I have no idea how to do it. I just know that I've heard this would be helpful. I've heard that would be helpful. And I repeat it. Now, that person may get some hint of how to proceed, may even get a taste of what it could be like if they knew what to do. But directly, one is not able to lead them into how to resolve their problem due to lack of understanding, lack of one's own ability to do the very thing you're trying to teach. And that can create more difficulty than it can be of service in some cases. Now, sometimes people share with each other. They say, hey, have you heard about this new thing? They say, yeah, this is very interesting, and I know this, and I know that. And somebody else says, well, I heard this, and I heard that. And there may be some right, there may be some wrong, but gradually they start to build up their fund of knowledge, and they start to research it and to start to share it more. So in that way, it can be quite helpful. So in that case, sharing the little bit you know can be advantageous to developing your capacity to learn more, your understanding how to learn more, and so on. But it is important to understand exactly the context within which you are being benefited by assisting others. Because if you think of yourself as the one who is giving it when you don't have it, you can be causing a lot of damage. Therefore, I like the terminology sharing. Because when you think about things as sharing, then you don't worry so much I don't worry too much about having to give. When you're sharing, it's okay. You can share as much as you have, and that's all right. But when you have to give something, then you even have to pretend, or you have to assume that you have the capacity to give. So sharing is a much more practical description than giving. So therefore, let's go to the situation where somebody has a realization, has knowledge, has ability to share something which can significantly transform a person's life. Naturally, such persons will have a greater capacity to be of assistance and will have a greater capacity to do things in a way which will give them enormous realizations, will give them enormous growth. I have seen the more you understand, the more you realize in your spirituality, the more you share those realizations, as you get up to certain levels, they compound geometrically, not arithmetically. They compound more. They expand more your awareness. It becomes more obvious, at least. So it is actually interesting when you consider how our realizations can expand, how our realizations can develop, how our spirituality can really grow in leaps and bounds when we actually have something significant to others that we can offer them. And when one is in the beginning stages of this, it is not so obvious. I mean, from the point one to the point three is also not necessarily an arithmetic, for example, a doubling. It's more than a doubling. But from a 40 to an 80 is much more dramatic, if you understand what I'm talking about. Now I'm getting the question, well, how does one then, therefore, estimate one's realization? How does one estimate? How does one understand how realized one is? Because one has been able to do spiritual tasks. One has been able to have some spiritual power. So what would be the estimation? How would one estimate it? I don't think it's necessary that you have to estimate it personally. Why do you have to bother estimating how advanced you are, understanding how advanced you are? You share. What we always share. We all have the capacity to share. And when you see that your sharing is having a great effect, not only on others, but on yourself, you can start to understand the value of it. I don't like the idea of a person having to quantify his realization, to having to place oneself on higher and lower levels and be aware of this placing, to have some kind of a requirement to be situated in a certain place and then engaging in some act. I would say it's more important to simply have the ideal of sharing as one's fundamental modus operandi, because within that ideal, all the elements will be properly placed. After all, you can only share what you have. But you could, for example, say things that you don't really know. You might even repeat improperly. But when you actually have something and you wish to share it, it's a safe thing, spiritually speaking. As an example of this, listen to how these two statements sound. The first statement, somebody says, "This is the absolute truth." The second statement, somebody says, "I have heard this, and I want to share this idea with you to see how you think about it." Where one can say, "I'm sharing this with you because I kind of like it. I think it might be helpful for us to share this." The other one is saying, "This is it. You take it now, please." Now, obviously, I'm making extremes here. Obviously, I'm exaggerating the situation. But I think that when you're sharing, you really have to have some connection to what you are sharing. It's a dangerous thing to give what you don't have, because then you're not really giving something. It's a vacuous gift. It's a gift which may even be a Trojan horse in some sense. Now, there are situations when a lot of people get together, a group of people get together, and they're sharing with each other in a way which they feel good about. And when they share with each other in this way they feel good about, the group can create a higher level of realization that everyone feels drawn towards. And in this sense, the group is certainly greater than the individual, because everybody's giving a little bit, and everybody can feel the intensity of it in a shared environment. And I think in that sense, the ideal of coming together and giving whatever you can contribute, is a very valuable thing. Ah, this is a very interesting question. Very badly worded, but now I've figured it out, and it's a really good question. Sometimes we get involved in helping others and we then realize that we're just using them to somehow or another make ourselves feel good or justify our existence or to simply avoid laziness. And then after that, when you realize it, you become very disappointed. And then in the old age, because this is something which can really impact us in our older age, we realize the thing that doesn't bring such a kind of a disappointment is bringing others to a point that they have independently captured the essence of it and mastered the situation and are developing themselves extraordinarily well. I think that's a great comment that was made here. It's really true that at one point, and I think I'm very thankful to this person for reminding me the whole point of this lecture, which is that when you get to a certain age, you're no longer satisfied with just the busy work of being of service to avoid your own problems. You realize that you really want to share. You really want to assist and be of service so others can grow and develop and be strong in themselves without dependency on you or without dependency on anyone else. And then you feel the joy of a teacher or of a master when the student actually becomes independently capable and superior even to the teacher. That is a very rare and unique joy, but one that we should all attain, we should all aspire to attain. So thank you, Nalini over there, for that question. It's a good one. That comment, actually, it's a good one. Here's another question. Why is it so that as we develop spiritually, we might not necessarily increase our bodily health? Are these two processes interrelated? And is the increasing of bodily health the measure, so to speak, of the increasing of one's vibrations and one's spiritual growth? That was too much. Huh? Maybe I should split it. Okay. Well, let's analyze this from many points of view, because actually there are different situations here which are interesting to speak about. For example, if we understand a person who has been living in the mode of passion, has been artificially expanding their energies in different ways, which are not necessarily natural. When somebody becomes more spiritually inclined, they drop that away, their energy level will kind of reduce. From that point of view, one might think that one's health is reducing, whereas in reality, one is cooling off all of this artificial stimulus in one's life and gradually building up, it'll take time, in a more natural basis of life. And then another situation which does arise, not in all cases, but it can arise, especially if one is inclined to do so according to one's group or one's understanding, is that the more one becomes absorbed in spirituality, the more one neglects the body, thinking it is material or maya or not important. In such situations, naturally the health will diminish because one is not taking care. One is not nurturing the body because one thinks there's no need to do so. It's a misunderstanding that causes bad health. Let's address the situation here where one says that the increasing of bodily health could be a measure of one's increased vibrations and spiritual growth, because that's a little complex. That becomes complex in the case of a person who neglected the body, got sick, then understood the ignorance which caused the neglect, rectified the situation, advanced spiritually into a holistic understanding, yet has already destroyed the body. So in that case, even though one would be of a spiritually advanced category, so to speak, one's health may not follow necessarily because of the previous situation. Now, let's take another example to clarify this even more. Let's say we are very aware of our essence, our spirituality, our vibrations in a holistic fashion. We are very much in touch with our spiritual energy. Naturally, the activities we do, the things that we do, will correspond to that and will be in harmony with our bodies. This will naturally bring about a better situation in health over the long run. But don't forget, we're not blank slates. We didn't start this moment in time, the present moment in time, with a blank slate behind us. There's a whole series of events, many of them based in neglect of the body or doing the wrong thing, which are affecting how we can develop in the future, especially as we get older. So there is not necessarily a connection between the two because of the complexity of the situations that we are all within. But our health and our spirituality are definitely interrelated. They're definitely related. It's just how and what you can do about it that becomes complex to talk about. Here's an interesting question. Sometimes when one shares one's very sacred and important feelings, one feels emptiness or even polluted when this is happening. And this person wants to know why. This is a very important question. Now, sometimes we think that sharing means you have to share everything. We get this idea of kind of a communal type of sharing. What is mine is yours. If I have this feeling, I can share it with you. And we kind of lose discrimination. Now, this is a very idealistic understanding. It's a very communistic kind of understanding, so to speak. It's not necessarily practical, and it may not even be healthy. Because people who are in this situation may not necessarily be speaking to the proper audiences, sharing with the proper audiences. You've heard the statement, throwing pearls before a swine. Have you heard that? You have to use discrimination to consider if the person that you are sharing with has the capacity to accept what you are sharing. Because when you share these very important things in your life with others who do not have the proper capacity, you can feel very disturbed. You can feel rather polluted by their not accepting it or twisting it or judging it or in some way not respecting it. And this is a very important thing to understand. Sharing does not mean you lose your capacity to discriminate. In fact, the more you share, the more you have to discriminate what you share, how you share, when you share, and with who. And therefore, age, maturity, is an important factor, because as you experience more, you start to build up a whole database of situations which will help you understand how to share. Because just blanket sharing, as in youth, can be damaging. That's the nature of this world, isn't it? That everything has multiple layers. I mean, there's not like a single formula you can follow. Just love, or just share, or just peace and love, or some kind of banner or saying or logo or motto which solves all problems. There's millions of situations you have to deal with. Okay, last question for today is, can one have God realization in the mode of passion? Well, I would like to avoid that phrase, mode of passion, because after all, it's a archetype. It's an archetypical understanding which nobody is in. Nobody is purely in the mode of passion. Even the so-called Lord of the mode of passion is not in the mode of passion. It's an archetypical understanding which therefore would not be useful in trying to answer this question. But the question is a really good question. So forgive me, I just want to take out those words mode of passion, and I want to put in words which are more representative of those qualities which we might consider fit within the mode of passion. Can a creative person have God realization? Well, sure. Can a person who has a passion for life have God realization? Who's very active in their activities? Sure. I mean, after all, eating in the mode of passion is supposed to be foods like, for example, even kachori and halva. Can a person who eats kachoris and halva have God realization? Sure. Can a person who has excesses in various aspects of their lives have God realization? Of course. Okay, let's take this question from another point of view. Can somebody who's predominantly self-occupied with their own expansions in a kind of a relentless drive to accomplish, Can they have God realization? Well, then it depends on what you mean by God realization. Do you mean like, for example, somebody who's completely in harmony with the divine? Then you could say, well, Lord Brahma, if you believe in Lord Brahma, the creator of the universe, sure, he would be considered to be such a person. Brahma, Brahma. So let's say you've got war. You're in a war. You're fighting. That's like pure passion. I mean, war is pure passion. There's not even ignorance involved or goodness involved. It's a pure passionate activity. But Arjuna engaged in it. And sure, God realization was there. So the answer to that question would be, it depends on who is the person engaging in acts which could fall into the category of passion. Because some businessman who's simply trying to make money all day, sure, if he's not a spiritualist, sure, he would not necessarily have that God realization because he doesn't have it anyway. Whereas a person who does have God realization can engage in business all day, or can engage in a war all day, or can create the universe all day, and not be any less in their God realization. Okay, let's take this question from another point of view. Let's say we're worried about being so much absorbed in a particular activity that we never have time to manifest that sharing of God realization or our realization. That may be a very serious concern that a lot of people would share. I mean, in the middle of the battlefield of Kurukshetra, you don't see Arjuna turning around and offering artik to Krishna. You don't see him, you know, doing some kind of prayer or whatever. He's in the middle of his activity. That activity as such is related to being of service. Therefore, he's manifesting his spirituality through that activity. So the activity and the service are one, and therefore it is of the spiritual nature, and one doesn't have to worry about it. Therefore, when you act, if you act within the context of your spirituality, it really doesn't matter what you do, because when it is within the proper context, it makes sense. And when you don't have that proper context, you need to find it. You need to frame your realization, your understanding, yourself, your energy, your desires. You need to frame it in a manner which is practical and useful in your life. And in this way, you will see practically how life within the proper context can manifest that service, can be of service, that life can be of service in ways that ordinarily one would not imagine. I mean, after all, who thinks of service going out and killing millions of people in a war could possibly be of service? The hardest thing to do is feel relevant in life when one is engaged in practical activities which one cannot directly perceive the result of, or one cannot have a direct feedback that, yes, this is right, this is spiritual, this is service. In other words, God comes down and tells you, thank you, this is great what you're doing. You know, but sometimes, and it's important to understand this, sometimes that which you think is valuable, or that which you think is going to really give you some benefit when you get that authorization or when you get that acknowledgement of what you're doing, can also be an illusion. It can be something which leads you into a fantasy land of comfort, which is not really connected with reality. But it depends on each and every case. It depends on each and every person. It depends on each and every situation. So one cannot really say for sure it is like this or it is like that, that you are an illusion, or no, this is correct. Because even the same person in the same situation, it can change from week to week or month to month or year to year. It's just that I'm trying to give some indication of how to understand this. So I would like to stop there for this week. I also would like to, if somehow or another, we could have more interactivity. I don't know if somebody would be interested in exploring that. But anyway, if you want me to speak about something, I'd be grateful. You can put it in the forums. There's a forum there for suggestions and everything. And I wish you all the best, and I hope that your situations will transform in a very difficult time we live in right now, a very unique time where changes are coming even when we don't want them to. So much love and happiness and success to all of you, and bye for this week.